And I'll never forget a meeting we had with Martin. He's kind of looking at it like, wait a minute. So there's this big opportunity, but there's three different entities fighting each other inside of Group M and WPP. And he got very, very angry. And he just said, I want one company that does this. And that was the birth of Zaxxas, really.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
So this week we are pumped to welcome Brian Lesser to the program. Brian is the CEO of InfoSum, which is a decentralized data collaboration platform. And before that, he was, of course, CEO of Xandr, which was the new name for AT&T Advertising and Analytics. And before joining AT&T in 2017, Brian had a long and legendary run in the world of WPP as CEO of Group M and Zaxxas and at MIG, not MIT, MIG, and 24/7 Real Media, where he worked for none other than Paleo EdTech fan favorite David Moore.
It's not who you know.
So we've heard that the advertising business runs in your family. Is that true? And can you tell us about that?
It is true. My father was in the advertising business. And frankly, that's a big part of why I joined the advertising business. But my dad ran advertising agencies when I was a kid. And I always thought it was fascinating what he did. I remember as probably a 9 or 10 year old going to see him. And at the time, he was the CEO of Ogilvy New York. And Ogilvy at that time was in Worldwide Plaza. And the office was incredible. It had like thick red shag carpets and wood paneled walls.
I remember on 8th Avenue.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that really got me interested in the business. I mean, he dressed in really nice suits and had funny friends that seemed really interesting. And then my brother, my oldest brother, Jim, worked for BBDO for 20 years or so. Just recently left a couple of years ago. So yes, advertising's in my family. I actually, my first thought when I was in college was I don't want to do advertising. So I was a political science major and I was going to go to law school. I interned for a senator between my sophomore and junior year of college and I absolutely hated it. So The next summer I said, well, let me give this advertising thing a try. And
what was it about politics that turned you off? Was it too serious?
Well, I worked in the district office of a senator named Frank Lautenberg, who was a longtime senator for New Jersey. And the district office did not do very glamorous things. It was like answering letters from constituents. And the staffers in his office were all kind of unanimous in saying like, hey, kid, don't do this. So I was kind of turned off by the work, I guess.
Advertising seemed more fun. Well, that's nice. Yeah, my father was a trauma doctor, and his job didn't look very fun at all. So no appeal. What did you do right after college?
I went to work for an advertising agency called DMB&B, Darcy, Macias, Benton & Bowles, which the Benton & Bowles part was, you know, as old as New York advertising gets. And I was an account manager. My client was Procter & Gamble. I worked on the Charmin toilet paper account. And I loved it. And then I think I moved from Charmin toilet paper to Pampers diapers. I think I did wipes next. They were baby wipes. Diapers. And then ultimately, the pinnacle of my account management career was I worked on the Vicks cough cold brands. And then the internet happened and I slowly migrated out of kind of traditional advertising agencies into more, you know, digital agencies. I worked for a company called IXL, which was one of the first big builders of websites when that was the thing. And then I worked at a couple startups before ultimately landing, you know, somewhere along the way, I went back to business school, but I landed at 24/7.
So what was your interview at 24/7 like? Do you remember the actual interview itself?
24/7 at the time had three businesses, an ad network, an ad serving business, and a search marketing business, technology.
Because they had already acquired Real Media, right?
It was 24/7 and Real Media combined to form 24/7 Real Media. And they had just acquired a company called Decide DNA, which was a search advertising tool. They were sort of in the process of rebooting product management. And so they had brought in new leadership to manage product. And they recruited me to run product marketing. And the interview, it was a long series of interviews. I remember like a full day and like a whiteboard session. But the feedback was pretty immediate. And I think the job offer came pretty quickly. And I jumped at it. Little did I know that that was going to launch me into a series of changes that would just be amazing for my career.
So that this was around 2006, right? 2007?
Correct. Yeah. 2006.
So that 2007 was a very big year for the space. There were a lot of acquisitions. I know Aparta was acquired and Right Media was acquired.
DoubleClick, yeah. DoubleClick was Google.
Yeah. So what did you think when all that was going on? Did you think something was changing?
Yeah. I mean, that was really like, that was sort of the first big acquisition spree of AdTech 1.0. And it felt to me like the world was changing pretty significantly and advertising was moving very quickly towards a data and technology enabled industry rather than, you know, it had been happening, obviously. But I think up until that point, there was still a lot of traditional advertising that was dominant. But when Google bought DoubleClick and Microsoft bought Aquantive and you know, even the WPP acquisition was significant. All three of those acquisitions, I think, occurred within a few months of each other.
They did. I think,
And so, yeah, it felt like something big was going on. And we were a small public company. I mean, I know you've talked to Dave more about this, but 24/7, it was really exciting to be at 24/7. And then we were bought by WPP. Ironically, my father worked for WPP. So for me, it was kind of like...
At that time?
Funny story, like years later, I finally asked Martin if he knew my dad. And he had not put it together until the moment I asked him. But he did. He said, oh, yeah, of course I know your dad.
So the you mentioned WPP acquiring 24/7. So that was in 2008, one of the big kind of turnaround stories epic stories of history, 24/7. Right. So what change did that make on 24/7, on the agency itself?
It was an enormous change. I mean, I think that, you know, the ad network business was very, very successful. The ad serving business was a bit of a grind because we were competing against DoubleClick. And Aquantive, or Atlas more specifically. And then the search marketing business was also very successful. But I think the way it changed the company is, you know, obviously we went from a small public company and all of the requirements that entails to being inside of WPP. So I think it freed up a lot of executives to really focus back on the business. And I think the second big thing was we were really happy to be within WPP and trying to determine how we as technologists and digital media experts could help WPP grow. I mean, that transaction was, I thought we were all very, very grateful to be inside of WPP. It wasn't one of those things where people were griping about it. Like, why are we, you know, part of a holding company? I think for the most part, people were really excited. I was. And
especially a hipster holding company. I mean, that was like the cool holding company.
Yeah. And we loved Martin. I mean, Martin paid a lot of attention to us. He obviously spent a lot of money on us. And we liked the guys from Group M, some of them. And, you know, so it did change strategically. It changed the direction of the company in the sense that we all of a sudden felt like we had a different purpose, you know, not just running the endemic businesses of ad serving, ad network, search marketing, but now how do we help WPP be even more successful? And actually, that's what created the Media Innovation Group. Was we decided that we were going to put together a small team of engineers and product managers and peel them off from 24/7 and dedicate them just to Group M and the agencies and build cool stuff that would help them create new products and build their business.
So this was like an engineering skunk works that was a subset of 24/7, but independent. So within Group M, I see. Correct. And who would they be serving? Would they be serving internal resources or is this for clients? Or were you selling these services to clients?
Well, the first big project we worked on, Marty, was, you know, effectively a DMP, although that didn't exist. That term didn't exist. I mean, BlueKai was sort of coming up. I don't even know if BlueKai would have called themselves a DMP at the time. But what we invented was we called it Zeus. That was the name of the product. And in fact, we did what you never should do in product marketing, which is we allowed the project name to turn into the product name. And Zeus was a data warehouse that we built for and in conjunction with Group M, where we could use pixels to collect data on all the digital advertising campaigns that Group M ran. And so it was a relatively simple, by today's standards, concept of...
You pixeled the ads.
Yeah. We basically, every time Group M ran a campaign for clients, we would pixel the ads, which means that we could collect data on the performance of those ads, but also on where those
without ads an ad server though. You didn't need one.
Well, we didn't need an ad server, but we actually paired it up with Open Ad Stream so that we could, you know, actually serve the campaigns as well. And you know, that product effectively, you know, was a database, a performance database, begat a business, which was sort of the first, you know, I think it was the first sort of trade desk like business within the holding companies. And what we would do is we would take campaigns from the agencies and we'd run them for them using our ad server and using that database, Zeus, and we would make them more performant. You know, that was kind of like the start of what would eventually become Zaxxis.
So how did you make them more performant? So was it through measuring effectiveness?
Yes. And we would target better because effectively we would know which placements were performing better and we could optimize the campaign over time. So,
okay. Because you had a granular, like kind of browser level picture of each campaign because you knew exactly when the ads were firing and then you could sync to the cookies. So that's kind of, it is a DMP, isn't it? But you didn't sell it as an independent DMP. So it's part of your WPP offering.
Well, frankly, that was part of the problem is we spent $6 million on it. And I remember going to Martin asking for the money, you know, some combination of me, Dave and John Sue, who was, you know, who was really influential in my career and sort of running 24/7 with Dave at the time. But he, you know, Martin was great. He said, well, what do you need it for? And we said, we want to build this new product that's going to help Group M be more effective, create new products. But we don't want to penalize ourselves because, you know, you're expecting us to hit our numbers absent this budget. And he was okay with it. I mean, he allowed us to do it, which was great.
And it was 6 million. That was literally the budget.
It was about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why I remember that number, but it was about that.
It sounds about right.
A big part of that was we bought a Netezza data warehouse, which sounds kind of ridiculous now, but
that went very fast. So back to 24/7 for a second. So it was acquired by WPP. Where was the office? And did Sir Martin actually come in and address you guys and welcome you to the team?
The office was on 31st Street, really lovely Penn Station neighborhood.
Oh, that's a nice area. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really this time of year when the flowers are coming out, it's really special. It's funny. I asked Dave Moore one time why the office was there, and it was because he lived on Long Island and it was next to Penn Station.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, Martin was around. He's a very accessible leader, at least he was at the time. And you know, I remember him coming into the office, addressing the employees of 24/7. And then, you know, we would see him all the time, really. Martin was famous for having at least quarterly check-ins, but sometimes more often than quarterly. So we had a report of our business results to him every quarter. And, he was always around.
Yeah. I heard he asked tough questions. That's what Dave Moore said. He said he would prepare and then Martin would somehow ask him the one question he didn't know the answer to.
Yeah. They were tough meetings. If business was good, they were fine. If business was not good, they were tough meetings.
Yeah. We have those too. So about Zaxxis. So Zaxxis, you know, didn't launch out of nowhere, obviously. I guess it's an iteration of Media Innovation Group. What inspired the company and you to launch Zaxxis? And what was the vision there? What did you think you were launching?
It was programmatic advertising that inspired the launch. And it was a combination of actually three different businesses. We had the Media Innovation Group. One of the agencies, MEC at the time, had developed their own kind of programmatic unit. They called it the Audience Buying and Planning Unit at MEC. And there was a business in Germany called Targad, which was run by my soon-to-be colleague, Mark Grether, at the time. All of these businesses were somewhat competing with each other inside of WPP. And it was kind of like we all felt it was like a little bit of a gold rush because programmatic was just emerging. It was very, very difficult to do. There are very few people that understood how to run a programmatic advertising campaign, much less build a business around it. And so, you know, various parts of Group M were kind of like going after this opportunity. And I'll never forget a meeting we had with Martin where the conflict between these internal groups became very apparent to him. And he's kind of looking at it like, wait a minute, so there's this big opportunity, but there's three different entities fighting each other inside of Group M and WPP, and he got very, very angry. And he just said, I want one company that does this, and I want everybody to use that one company. And that was the birth of Zaxxas, really. I mean, it happened, you know, 6 months later. We did a ton of work on putting these things together, and what does the management team look like, and what's the brand going to be, and what's the service offering, the product, et cetera. And then about 6 months later, we launched it, which was 2011.
So when he got angry in that meeting, did he then turn to you and say, Brian, solve this problem?
Yeah. I mean, in my memory, it was something like that, Marty. Yeah. I think in my memory it was, and you're the only one that can solve this problem.
That's what I envisioned, but I just wanted to double check that.
Yeah. No, I'm sure that's how it happened.
So Zaxxas, the name, so that's X-axis, right? Why an X-axis? Isn't there a Y-axis? On?
Yeah, but Yaxxas doesn't sound as cool.
that's true. It really doesn't.
We hired an agency, a WPP agency, obviously, to come up with the brand name. And I didn't really like it at first, to be honest with you. You probably know it's very difficult to come up with a creative name for a business. And the nice people that helped us with it, the brief was, hey, this is going to be a data and technology inspired business. And we help organize data such that we make advertising more effective and efficient, and we make messaging more relevant. And so the idea was X-axis implies data, and the X-axis never ends. It's infinite. And so it was theoretically an infinite amount of data that we help organize and activate. And that's how we came up with the name. And, you know, I said the same thing when we named Xander. Yeah. Half of you are going to like it, half of you are going to hate it. I don't care, because a couple of years from now, it'll just be part of the fabric and you won't even notice.
It's true. I mean, Zaxxas is part of history now, as is Xander. So you and I have spoken in the past about how difficult it is to explain to clients what Zaxxas did. What was your pitch in the beginning? Like when you went into an account and you said, I have this thing called Zaxxas, how did you explain it?
At the time, the media buying in digital media buying was sort of a tale of kind of two sides of like a media plan. One was, and again, this is 2011, you would buy really premium digital publishers directly. And that was, you know, sort of not very targeted, but it was sort of like the brand advertising of digital. But of course, you needed to fill that in with lots of reach and performance, and you'd buy ad networks for that. And, you know, there were dozens and dozens of ad networks that were meeting that need. So what we said when we created Zaxxas was, you're leaving a lot of value on the table when you use a range of ad networks, because yes, ad networks have data and they're really smart about optimization, but you can't see across those ad networks. You know, you're basically buying in silos, and you can't deduplicate your reach, and you can't really optimize the way you're supposed to. So allow us, Zaxxas, to tag up your entire campaign so that we're collecting data across every entity that you advertise with, and then let us optimize, you know, across all of these buys. So we were still buying ad networks at the time. I mean, at least in the US we were, I think less so in other parts of the world. But the pitch was really, let us use data and technology to make these campaigns perform even better. And that was even before we started talking about using a DSP, you know, to buy in a marketplace. I mean, at the time in 2011, that was actually a relatively small part of our business. But of course, that would grow to be the majority, if not all that we did was sort of buy in programmatic marketplaces.
I mean, there was a perception around that time that ad networks were on their way out, which indeed they were. And we had Andrew Casale on, and he had an ad network, which he had to sort of pivot into an SSP.
Yeah, that was always going to happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, there were some really good ad networks.
It just, some were better than others.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense. You know, it had to evolve the way it did.
Yeah. So how did Zaxxas make money?
We would take a percentage of the campaign effectively. So right, depending on how well we could perform, you know, we could take a percentage of the campaign. And we were very transparent with our customers about that. I mean, later, you know, a few years later, we would deal with sort of the whole transparency issue,
sure,
in a much more serious way. But at the time, Group M had compliance and governance that basically said, okay, use Zaxxas can take a percentage of these campaigns, but you need to tell the client that you're going to take a percentage. That, you know, that's how the business model worked, is we would just take a percentage based on the performance of the campaign.
Okay. So 2013 was around the Rockefeller era. So then Rockefeller went public, and so their margins were 40-50%, and everybody got sort of confused by take rates for campaigns. And did that have any impact on your business or the way the questions the clients were asking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the beginning, like a lot of industries and a lot of technologies that emerge in marketing and advertising, programmatic was really hard in the beginning. And the fact that we could do it at all meant that, you know, nobody was really bothered by the fact that we were getting paid to do it. I think as it became more ubiquitous over time, and as those types of revelations came out that, you know, Rocket Fuel and others were getting a 40-50% margin, it did get more difficult for us. And, you know, we had to explain how the business model worked. Later, it would evolve to, and Zaxis is still a really successful growing company today. So clearly, it stood the test of time. But since then, there are now advertisers that won't use Zaxis because of its, you know, non-disclosed business model. And so, yeah, it did get difficult for us for a while. Probably like, you know, sort of 2016-17, I think was, or maybe 15-16 was the worst of it. And then it sort of settled down, and, you know, we kind of were able to justify what we got paid and how we got paid.
So you became CEO of Group M around 2015. Was that a change in your job?
No, it was a huge change. I always say,
what happened?
I always say I was so successful at Zaxis, I got promoted. But since this is a podcast, you can't see that I'm using air quotes.
Air quotes into promotion.
Promoted. Yes,
I see that. Yeah.
No, I went from a job I really, really loved to a job I didn't love as much. Group M was an awesome place at the time. I mean, Irwin Gottlieb was CEO, and lots of really smart, interesting people there. I worked very closely with Rob Norman, amongst others. But the Group M job was very different than Zaxis. Zaxis was running a company, you know, and we were thousands of people all over the world with a really successful business, but it was one business. Group M, I think when I was there, there were something like 17 or 18 different entities within Group M North America.
Ooh.
From the big ones like Mindshare and Wavemaker and Maxis at the time, Mediacom, et cetera, to much more niche businesses, including Zaxis. And my job was to effectively come up with a platform and a set of processes that we could all agree on, you know, to make the business as efficient as possible. And to try to get 17 or 18 companies all using the same platform and the same process is, you know, a difficult task.
I can only imagine. That's a tough job. How often did you speak to each one of the entities?
I had a staff meeting every week, and at least the four big agencies, which at the time were Mindshare, MEC, Maxis, and Mediacom. And so I'd see them at least once a week. But Group M also has a matrix, which makes it very difficult to manage because all of the CEOs reported to me, but they also reported to their global agency CEO. So it just made it, it was a fun and interesting job. It's like lots of influence, but the power, you know, sort of was elusive.
So 2017, you surprised at least me by going to AT&T, leaving WPP and joining a large communications company. And why did you make that move?
It surprised me as well, to be honest with you.
How about your wife? Was she surprised?
Yeah, she was very supportive, but I don't think anybody really understood what I was getting into. I'm not sure I understood what I was getting into.
It's an adventure.
It was an adventure, and I have more good things to say about it than bad things. But what happened was, I mean, I was not unhappy at Group M. As I've described, it was a difficult job, but I was doing it, and we were getting a lot of things done. So I wasn't unhappy there. I had known a very senior executive recruiter in the business for years, and we had developed a relationship. And he called me up one day and he said, "I think I got something you'd be interested in. AT&T just bought or announced that they're going to buy Time Warner. They bought DirecTV, and they want to start an advertising business that combines the data of the telco with the media of DirecTV and Warner Brothers, or Time Warner rather, and kind of build a platform and a marketplace that puts all these things together. And he said, they're looking for a CEO to do it. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely not. No way. Yeah. Because I've seen this movie before and
at Verizon.
Telcos can't get this right, you know, and I refuse to be the sacrificial lamb for AT&T. So he tried to convince me and he said, well, think about it. I said, okay, well, just so I know, what's the interview process? And he said, well, the first interview is you fly down to Dallas and you meet Randall Stephenson, who at the time was chairman and CEO of AT&T. I said, really, that's the first interview? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I'd be an idiot not to fly down to Dallas and meet Randall Stephenson. So why don't I do that? And I did. I met Randall, and it was the morning that Amazon bought Whole Foods that was announced. And I think the first 15 or 20 minutes of the interview, we just talked about that because it was such an interesting transaction. And that led us into a conversation about corporate strategy and how companies evolve. And he told me about his strategy to evolve AT&T into what he called the modern media company. And we hit it off. We had a really great conversation, and he sold me. He convinced me that AT&T was going to do this right and give me the resources I needed. And, I later would meet more of the team, John Donovan, John Stankey, Lori Lee, lots of important executives at AT&T. And they all convinced me. So they kind of won me over, and I took the leap.
Yeah, challenge accepted, right? They had the huge media business, Warner Media. They had data, a lot of data, and they obviously had advertising potential. So in 2017, you made the move, and then they had something called the AT&T Advertising and Analytics, which became Xandr pretty quickly. I think the Xandr brand was launched within a year of your joining. What happened there? What was that process?
There were a few different advertising businesses. The biggest one in AT&T proper was the DirecTV business. And that was about a $2 billion advertising business. And the best part of that business was the addressable television business. So that was because DirecTV owned the set-top box, we could dynamically insert advertising at that at the set-top box level, and it was a great product. You know, it was really the CTV has now since taken off, but that was really the first kind of product that allowed you to dynamically serve advertising in a TV environment. And so that was one business. And then there was the Warner Media business, which I really didn't have any purview over because AT&T had not yet acquired Warner Media. In fact, I had only been with AT&T for about a month when the Justice Department sued to block the acquisition, and I got caught up in that whole thing.
The Justice Department is suing to block AT&T's $85 billion purchase of Time Warner, the owner of CNN.
So a big part of my first 9 months at AT&T was sort of kind of helping with that lawsuit and educating on advertising and how important it would be to the tie-up. But AT&T Advertising Analytics was really just two things. It was that DirecTV business, and I was given management of the big data team at AT&T, which was an enterprise-wide team that was working on a single identity solution for AT&T and DirecTV. And so that was what I managed. And we knew we were going to need advertising technology. We had a lot of advertising technology in-house, but it was all associated with the DirecTV business. And I knew that we were going to build, you know, the strategy was to build a platform that would enable advertising to be targeted across any channel, including television, video, display, et cetera. So I knew we were going to need more tech. And literally from the first conversation I had with Randall, we knew we were going to go out and acquire some businesses. And, you know, so we launched
that led you to AppNexus.
So that led us to AppNexus. And then we needed to rebrand everything because it was just getting confusing. It was DirecTV. It was AppNexus. It was these other parts of AT&T. So, you know, we went through a branding exercise and we came up with Xandr.
So AppNexus, I mean, were there other companies that you considered acquiring? Did you go through a process or
No, we went through a process and, you know, we actually had our sights set on multiple acquisitions and much bigger, broader acquisitions. But it was a strange time, Marty, because
DSPs, SSPs.
Yeah, we looked at everything. we looked at everything.
Google.
We were not going to acquire Google, but we were thinking big. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
nobody knew for sure if we were going to win the lawsuit against the Justice Department. And without Time Warner, the advertising business, at least our strategy for the advertising business, would have taken on a very different sort of, we would have had to think differently about the strategy. So we were looking, we were kind of looking for something to acquire at the same time we were fighting this lawsuit. And the two came together almost simultaneously, because at some point we knew that the case looked very good. And Randall said, okay, we're going to win this thing. And I want you to hit the ground running once we do. And so we started the process of evaluating who we could acquire and doing the diligence, and ultimately did the deal with AppNexus.
AppNexus, you know, obviously co-founded or founded by Brian O'Kelly, and then you acquired them and brought them on board. What was that integration process like? You know, it seems that culturally there may have been some challenges.
It was interesting.
Yeah. Interesting there, conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I could tell you some stories over drinks. I mean, it was, AppNexus was a very well-defined culture. Xander was not, because we had literally just formed that company. The ad sales team at DirecTV had an awesome culture. So, you know, it was a little bit of a mashup. And, you know, for me, it was definitely a management challenge. I would say it's always difficult to acquire a company and to try to create a culture when you're combining that company with others and trying to create one entity. So I learned a lot in it, you know, in that process. But yeah, there were some challenges along the way. I think in the end, I still keep in touch with a lot of people at Xander. And now it's, as you know,
part of Microsoft.
Going to Microsoft. And so clearly there was some value there that we created, because Microsoft could have bought a lot of things, and they bought Xander. So it wasn't easy.
So much happened too, because WarnerMedia, I mean, as you said, the acquisition went through and you know, became part of AT&T, and now it's being spun off momentarily, I believe, and as part of Discover. So it'll be Discover WarnerMedia. And then Xander was part of AT&T, and then it was sort of sold off to Microsoft. So things shifting around a lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, AT&T had a really aggressive, bold strategy, and clearly walking that back now. But, you know, frankly, I think WarnerMedia is going to be great with Discovery, and I think Xander is going to be great with Microsoft. So hopefully it all works out in the end.
Get your name out there.
So in 2020, you left AT&T, read about it in Adweek, and it said it was a surprising departure. Was it a surprising departure?
It was surprising. I think the writing was on the wall when Randall Stephenson stepped aside and John Stankey took over. Not that I couldn't work with John Stankey. He's a great guy and a smart guy. It's just that the strategy was shifting, and I knew it was shifting. And it was sort of one of those situations, Marty, where what I was hired to do was probably not really going to happen. And that was becoming pretty obvious to me. And so it just felt like a good time for me to leave. And it was an amicable parting of ways. And I think it was surprising, because we had just gotten started and we were making really good progress. But again, you know, kind of the winds of change were sort of telling me that what I had signed up to do, I was not going to be able to do. And so that was a good time to exit.
So you joined InfoSum during the pandemic. Did you interview on Zoom?
Well, I was a customer of InfoSum. So
okay.
I knew Nick Halstead, our founder, because I had met him at the end of 2019. I was trying to solve this data problem at AT&T. And I also had, I paid an absurd amount of money to Data on Borders when I was at Xander. And so I was looking
for... Who shall remain nameless?
And so I was looking for a more efficient way to compare my data set to my customers' data sets. And we found InfoSum, and I was really excited to find them. And AT&T Xander became one of the biggest customers. In fact, AT&T invested in InfoSum. So ironically, Xander has a small position in InfoSum. Okay. And so that's how, like, when I left AT&T, I was not really in a rush to do anything. I left in March of 2020. So that's just when COVID was affecting the world. And I was very happy to sit at home and, you know, spend some time with my kids, who I hadn't seen in about 12 years. And
they're like, who are you, sir?
Exactly. So, but Nick Halstead, our founder, he said, well, if you're not too busy, why don't you join our board and help raise some money and help run the company. So that sounded like the perfect thing for me. You know, I was not busy. And so I joined the InfoSum board and we raised a Series A shortly thereafter. I got to know the team. I got to know the product even better. And then later that year, it was like November of 2020, the board asked me to join full-time as CEO. So I kind of eased into it.
So what does InfoSum do exactly?
We allow data-centric companies to compare their customer data set with other customer data sets without having to commingle them in a third-party database. I liken this to, you know, when programmatic advertising was invented, we decentralized the system of buying and selling ads. I think the same thing is going to happen in the world of data collaboration. Right now, if two parties want to work together and compare their data sets, effectively, they push their data into the middle to a service provider, technology provider that aggregates that data, matches it, anonymizes it, sends it back. You could think of those companies as the ad networks of customer data because they are not transparent. They earn a very large margin. And, you know, in some cases, they're not very effective. And what we do is instead of having everybody send their data to us, we license them technology and our customers upload customer data into that technology. And we call those bunkers. And instead of the bunkers having data commingled, the data is transformed into a mathematical model. And using our platform, you can compare those models rather than comparing the granular customer data. So it is a decentralized approach to collaboration, and it has lots of applications from very basic data onboarding to data clean rooms where you can perform analytics or measurement to data co-ops, you know, a big retailer that wants to work with 25 of its partners in a co-op environment, but doesn't have a means for those partners to trust each other or compare their customer data sets without combining it. So there's lots of applications for it. You know that our industry in marketing and advertising has sort of now settled on this notion of clean rooms. Not my favorite term, but fine. And I do think that it's going to be a big part of how companies collaborate in the future for any number of reasons, from deprecation of cookies to legislation to trust and privacy issues. But I do think it's going to be a big part of how companies collaborate. And you know, we're growing very, very quickly. So it's been a fun ride.
Do you think you would ever see yourself going back to ad world and being CEO of an agency someday?
I would never say never. It's not on my short list of opportunities.
What's on the short list?
Well, I mean, I really like running a technology company, frankly. Yeah. And the agency business is great. And, you know, it's really bounced back over the last couple of years. But, you know, I think managing your career is sort of like you always want to be learning new things and doing new things. So it's probably unlikely that I would go back, but I would never say that.
If you are enjoying Paleo Ad Tech, we'd like to invite you to spread the word. Please follow me at Marty Kine on Twitter and leave us a review at your favorite podcast distribution platform.